Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
And tonight, this entire arena stands united in forceful condemnation of the thugs who perpetrate hatred and violence. But the very dishonest media, those people right up there with all the cameras.
American taxpayers fork out for a billionaire to fly across the country to go on television and complain about how hard his life is. My guests Isabel Hilton and Florence Biederman will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the latest efforts to bring North Korea to heel by yanking the chain of its business partners. French President Emmanuel Macron dares ask whether there's any wiggle room on freedom of movement in the EU. And Ukraine tears down its last statue of Lenin. Is there really any reason to maintain monuments to oppressors? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and Florence Biederman, London Bureau Chief for AFP. Welcome both. Now, on Monday night, as you may recall, US President Donald Trump gave a televised address on America's involvement in Afghanistan. Though vague and insubstantial in content, it was at least rather competently executed in style, give or take the reference to Afghanistan's prime minister, an office abolished some years back. This did prompt the usual, by George, I think he's got it, exclamations from relieved American political commentators. And then Trump, who appears to believe that the 2020 campaign has already started, held a rally in Phoenix and reverted wretchedly to type. Isabel, is there any doubt remaining at this point that the campaign Trump is the real Trump? That is who he is.
Well, I can't see any doubt. I find the chorus of how presidential he's become when he manages to read autocue without going off message, you know, pretty weird at this point, because
It's a low bar, isn't it?
Well, the only thing that would make Trump presidential is a head transplant, and that there's no sign of that. So, yeah, absolutely the campaign Trump. And it's clearly where he's happiest. You know, he goes off and he does rallies. Now, the problem is he's president now. So the things that he says in rallies, you know, you can't just say, oh, well, that's Trump on the campaign.
Or can we at this point, though? Because, Florence, the speech he gave, it was sort of a ramble, really. Things pop into his head and he says them. But it was the greatest hits. We have heard all this stuff before. The media are terrible. He gets great crowd sizes. He's going to build a wall, make America great again, etc., etc., etc. This is what the next 3.5 years is going to be like, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And the point is that it can last still another 3.5 years. Because, yes, his style is incredible. I mean, he's shocking everybody, the liberals, etc. But he's still the president. And despite of this style, he's still in power and he will still be. And why? Because also he speaks crazy, but he doesn't act that crazy either. I mean, also, like, there is always a way for him to retreat. Like, look at Afghanistan. I mean, during the campaign, he said, oh, no, we cannot stay there. And then after, say, oh, I'm behind the Oval Desk. And, well, I see it otherwise. So you see many aspects of his policy that were presented in a very provocative Trumpist way. And in the end, his actions are less provocative than the way he talks, I think.
But I think he's going to run out of people to blame for his failure to deliver on the domestic agenda. I mean, he's already blamed the Democrats for the Republican failure to produce healthcare reform when the Republicans have a majority in both houses. He's actually not on speaking terms with Mitch McConnell at this point. So promising
Who would be?
Well, indeed, but one sympathy on both sides. But he needs him, and he's offended so many Republicans that there's some doubt as to whether he would be the candidate in 2020 anyway. But his inability to get anything through Congress, I think, is going to continue. I mean, he doesn't know how to do it, for a start. And who's he going to blame, you know, for the next 3 years?
Do you think it is going to tell against him, though? Because this is what has struck me throughout his, not just his presidency, but his run. He says things that he knows, or that, whether he knows or not, that aren't true. He makes promises he knows that, or at least that he won't be able to deliver, whether he knows it or not. And there is clearly a large part of his own base that simply does not care.
Well, that's true, and he still has disturbingly high approval in the Republican, amongst Republican voters. But his general approval is low, and I can't see it rising, actually. So I think that he is going to be increasingly sounding like a man who just can't get anything done. This is the great deal maker. This is the guy who was supposed to cut through everything and get stuff done in a way that politicians can't. He's not going to be able to do that.
Florence, is his continued whining about the media and its treatment of him actually damaging the media? It seems there seems to be more evidence that it's having the opposite effect. If you look at the subscription figures for outlets like NPR, The New York Times, etc., etc., they have all spiked massively thanks to his presidency.
Yeah, I think he's a good client for the media, whether he likes it or not, and because he's criticising them. So there will be always a part of his base, as Isabel said, who will believe what he says and who will say, yes, media are liars, and this won't change. But maybe progressively people realise more and more how manipulative he is. So maybe also this topic won't be usable anymore after a while. But still, after 6 months, obviously, it's still useful for him.
Perhaps the media should just start referring to him as Agent Trump and thanking him profusely for all he's doing and sending, you know, much as Alice Cooper used to send big bunches of flowers to Mary Whitehouse every time she complained about his records being played on the BBC.
They may end up being the only constituency who still... have reason to be grateful, since he's offended most of the world, including, you know, the US's closest allies.
There were a couple of semi-new themes in last night's blurt. He did lean, or at least refer to, the statues controversy, which we will come to later in the programme, talked about they're taking away our culture and history, which...
And they hate our country.
Yes. Exactly. It's. But again, is this going to play anywhere but his base? This famous 60% of Trump supporters who, in a recent poll, said literally nothing he could do or say would change their minds about him.
I seriously doubt it's going to win anyone else over. After all, it wasn't the media who were trying to take the statues down. You know, it was citizens and voters in the relevant places in the South that want to rewrite the, I suppose, the dominant narrative, as you might say. But you know, that's fine. That's what happens in history, and I don't think it's going to be. I don't think blaming the media for that is going to win anyone over. Meanwhile, he has done some rather more alarming things. You know, his observations about Pakistan are pretty concerning. The Pakistan-India-Afghanistan rewrite that he delivered in the course of his other speech is going to make a very messy situation messier.
Florence, the thing that strikes me about Trump, and it struck me just when I was sort of writing this part of today's program, that because we're so familiar with what he's now going to do every time he goes on a stage, it does become quite difficult to find new things to say about it or new ways to interpret it. Is there a danger there if Trump realizes, or if Trump starts to worry, that people are getting kind of bored with his shtick? His one unarguable talent, verging on actual instinctive genius, is for creating spectacle and attracting attention to himself.
But I think he can do and play with that for years. I mean, as Isabel said, with Pakistan, for example, now it's emerging Pakistan is again an enemy. I mean, who will be the next enemy? And each time people will follow the debate because they will be worried, because it changes the balance that has been established in the recent years. You have to follow what he says and to be scared about his provocations, because he's still a guy with a lot of power. So there is an unending list of topics that he can go on with and make people feel uneasy. So you cannot discard it and say, oh, well, that's Trump. Well, this guy is still a president.
And I think that he also has the capacity to create crises that he then can't handle. And I do think that destabilizing the India-Pakistan relationship, which was hardly warm in the first place, over Afghanistan, is creating a future crisis that he's not going to be able to deal with.
OK, well, let's move along slightly now. Donald Trump did find the time during his interminable oration in Phoenix to briefly address the subject of North Korea. He said of Kim Jong-un that, "I respect the fact that I believe he is starting to respect us. I respect that fact very much. Respect that fact." That is a direct quote. Divining what, if anything, this actually means could take us some while, but it is the fact that the US has taken some concrete action in respect of North Korea. The US Treasury Department has imposed new sanctions on 16 Russian and Chinese individuals and entities accused of facilitating Pyongyang's nuclear program. Florence, is this fair enough, sanctioning North Korea's collaborators?
It can be a way of moving things. I mean, it can be a way to pressure China to act, but there is limit to what China can do, which Trump will discover also soon enough. So in the end, whether it will have an impact, I mean, more than psychological, it remains to be seen. Because what, again, can Russia and China do towards Pyongyang? Nobody thinks China is really master of the game with North Korea.
Isabel, is there a limit to what China can do? There is this conventional wisdom, which may well be flawed, as conventional wisdoms often are, that at basically any point China can just yank the plug out of the wall and that's it for North Korea.
Well, that's the nuclear option, if you like.
Probably a phrase best kept away from this
indeed,
discussion.
But that's the non-nuclear nuclear option. You know, you can... And as the Chinese might point out, were they in the room, you know, if you precipitate a collapse in North Korea, you have no idea what this regime might do on its way down. So perhaps best not. But China's influence in North Korea has been declining for, you know, at least 15, 20 years. And at this point, Russia has far more sway in North Korea than China has. And you might think that President Trump might call his old friend Vladimir Putin and ask him to do something constructive, but we see no sign of that.
I think it's Putin that calls him, not the other way around. Florence, is there, however, any argument at all, which Trump and certainly his surrogates have been keen to propagate, that his approach to North Korea is kind of working? This idea that, you know, he told it like it.
You can
at least let me finish the question before you start laughing.
You don't have to be an expert to laugh about it. No, I mean, he is posting like fire, fury. That was very nice. You know, that was what everybody would like to tell Kim Jong-un, but it never worked. I mean, this Korean problem has been there since decades and nobody could solve it because it's so complicated. And by the way, do you really want like North Korea not to exist anymore? Do you really want to see millions of Koreans fleeing this country? This is also another question and another reason why maybe some countries like China are not so keen to see situation evolving quickly. So there is also the solution. But no, I mean, there is no easy solution. I mean, if there was one, it would have been found before by the maybe more clever presidents in the United States. That's where Trump's predecessor.
And while Kim Jong-un has not actually fired a missile at Guam, he did announce this week that he was stepping up research into solid fuel rocketry, which would make his missiles much quicker to launch. And, you know, the remaining technical problems that he has with his ICBMs, he announced that they're going to work on it ever harder. So I don't think that's a sign of giving in.
But Isabel, that prospect that Florence raised, which is raised often when people talk about what might follow the regime of North Korea, and none of the options look terribly good. But basically, what is China's preferred model? Is it just that the Democratic People's Republic of Korea exists for eternity, but hopefully doesn't vaporize most of the region due to mishap or intent at some future point? Or does it favor, if you will, a kind of managed dismantling of the Pyongyang regime?
It has favored for some time, since the Deng Xiaoping era. It has favored an evolution of the North Korean model towards something, you know, the same path that China took. So they've been setting up small factories in North Korea, trying to start that journey towards a more developed economy and a more opening to the outside world, which Deng Xiaoping tried to persuade Kim Il-sung to follow. And Kim Il-sung did at one point promise that if Deng Xiaoping agreed to Kim's being succeeded by his son, which Deng Xiaoping was against, that if he didn't stand in his way, Kim Il-sung would ensure that Kim Jong-il came to China regularly to learn how it was done. Now, since then, it clearly North Korea has not really been following that path. But China's idea was that if North Korea could have an economy which was on a firmer footing, then the regime would become less aggressive and less difficult. It was also strongly against North Korea developing a nuclear program, and that was ignored.
Florence, this is another means in which the Trump factor comes into play here, though, isn't it? Because if sanctions are taken against China and especially against Russian entities, and you know, and Russia is also an influence upon North Korea, then does North Korea and the world take any US sanctions against Russia less seriously than it might because of doubts that people might have about whether or not the US president, and you know, every time I say sentences like this, it reminds you how weird these times are, because of actual doubts people have about whether or not the president of the United States is on the hook to the Kremlin?
It's still a question. I mean, I really don't have the answer to that. But is it taken seriously? Are these sanctions something serious that will really have an impact in the crisis? I think we can really doubt.
It's kind of interesting to notice that Tillerson's remarks on North Korea were rather more conciliatory and congratulating North Korea for not going totally out of the reservation this week. And it does make me wonder what back-channel communication might be going on and through whom. Because, you know, simultaneously trying to renegotiate South Korea's trading relationship with the United States, alienating China and Russia, there aren't very many channels left for the kind of diplomacy which might finally defuse this crisis.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Isabel Hilton and Florence Biedemann. Coming up next, Emmanuel Macron travels in search of a more appreciative audience.
Are you looking to strike a better work-life balance? If so, then the shiny new September issue of Monocle magazine is just what the doctor ordered. Join Monocle's business team as they head for the most agreeable third-tier cities. Moving advice for those on the hunt for a new live-work base. Breathe in, breathe out, and discover why third-tier definitely doesn't mean third-class. Step into the office of some select founders and CEOs to see exactly how they go about their work, from illustrator Christoph Niemann to legendary designer Dries Van Noten. And there's more. Hear from the first female Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, illuminating views on Geneva's neon scene, a walk through the transformative architecture of Jakarta, and savour the sight of Sweden's garden restaurants brought to delicious life on the page. That's all in the September issue of Monocle, on newsstands everywhere now, or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
How do Europe's business leaders start their day?
Everyone's seeing the possibility of what reforms could do to unleash the power of the Indian economy is really exciting.
Who tracks the stories that really matter like no one else?
You're going to take so much money out of the Greek economy that they can't possibly generate growth. You have to manage a transition to a more private-oriented economy.
Where can you have a real conversation to kickstart your working day?
You don't mean the referendum on gay marriage, do you?
I don't. Surprising.
Very interesting. And the International New York Times has a piece. They assume that it will be passed. Mm-hmm.
The answer to all these questions is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Weekdays at 7 a.m. in London.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Florence Biedemann and Isabel Hilton. Now, of the four much vaunted freedoms on which the EU is founded, those of goods, capital, services and labour, the latter is by far the most troublesome, and many essentially liberal politicians have tripped themselves up addressing it. The latest to try is French President Emmanuel Macron, who on a brief tour of Central and Eastern Europe took issue with the practice by which firms in poorer countries send workers to richer ones, who then earn a rich country's minimum wage while paying poor country taxes, depriving the receiving country of revenue and providing the receiving country's workers with cheaper competition. Florence, Macron said, and I quote, "The single European market and the free movement of workers is not meant to create a race to the bottom in terms of social regulations." Is that a fair assessment of what is going on here?
Yeah, it is. I mean, he's during his campaign, and he has been electing on one of the bases that he was pro-European and that he would try to change European laws and directive. And this is what he tries to do. And the detached workers is one of the main issues in France because there are so many of them, also in Germany. And changing the rules, like the tax rule or the social rules, is not really preventing the freedom of circulation, but it's a way to curb it. So certainly he can achieve that.
Because what he also said was it's exactly this that is fueling populism and eroding confidence in the European project. He's not wrong there, is he?
No, he's not. And I think what he wants to escape from is a kind of populist wave with the result that we saw with Brexit. It was clear during the campaign also that the anti-European feelings were high in France, not as high as in the UK, but with Marine Le Pen and also with Jean-Luc Mélenchon. So he knows this is a danger. And that's why one of his first moves is to try to tackle this question of changing European laws.
Isabel, why is the EU so dogmatic on free movement? It could spare itself a lot of headache if it was willing to compromise on this. It could have forestalled Brexit, for example, which was basically a referendum on immigration, whether anybody wanted to admit that to themselves or not. And it would, as President Macron is suggesting, massively deflate the appeal of populist and outright xenophobic parties.
Up to a point. I mean, if you go further east, the xenophobic parties exist in countries which actually supply this labour.
So you make Hungary a reasonable point.
And Poland, etc. And they're concerned about a different sort of immigration. But I think the point, I mean, if you look at Macron's programme and his ambition to reform domestic labour conditions in France and to tackle the unions and to do all these things which have been very difficult to do in France, I think it's a pretty much a quid pro quo for him, that he would find that easier to do if he had been able to achieve something on the question of labour costs or the cost of employment of cheaper labour, if you like. It's not just about the wages. It's about all the associated costs in France of employing people, which are avoided through these various schemes and wheezes. It's very hard for the European Union to take down one pillar of, you know, it's a foundational principle of the European Union. And once you start questioning, if you like, the kind of basis of the Treaty of Rome, then you open up the whole can of worms. And it's very difficult, I think, just to take one part of it away. Because, you know, as soon as you take free movement of labour away, then what are you left with? Free movement of capital. And you go back to the argument of the old left in this country that this is a capitalist club. So it has to offer something to people. Which people, who benefits and who suffers is what they have to sort out. And that's what Macron, it seems to me, is trying to do.
Florence, if Macron does make any kind of progress on this, or indeed even if he's just seen to be trying to make some progress on this, does this do anything for his approval rating, which has cratered at a rate of knots since he took office?
Well, I don't think it will have a big impact. And the crucial question will be whether he can or not reform labour law. And the test is coming now. He started discussion with the employers. He will have this discussion with the trade union. And that is the real challenge for him. What happens in the EU also is part of it, but this is not what will be looked at first by the trade unions, by the employees in France. It's the unemployment rate and the reform of labour law and what is done, what is considered as changing all the acquis sociaux. That's the tricky question for him.
Okay, well, finally tonight, while the United States continues to bicker about the propriety of maintaining monuments to mutineers and turncoats, Ukraine has completed a project to remove all of its remaining statues of Lenin. The 1,320th and last has now been pulled down, completing the work of a law passed in 2015. More than 1,000 other Soviet-era monuments are now destined for museums, theme parks, or scrapyards. The law has been less rigorously enforced, funnily enough, in those parts of Ukraine presently occupied by Russia. Isabel, first of all, there's the argument that has been floated in the United States these last couple of weeks, the somewhat specious one, when one realises that most of these monuments to Civil War leaders were erected many decades after the conclusion of hostilities, usually at points at which there was a special agitation for voting rights for black people and so on. The dynamic is not hard to figure out there. But is there any particular reason why the people of Ukraine or any other former Soviet-occupied country should be expected to put up with statues of Lenin?
I really don't think there is. I mean, actually, in all former socialist countries where you had massive statues of the leader, you've seen this process go on. I mean, the Languages Institute that I first attended in Beijing back in the day had one of those absolutely enormous and rather ugly statues of Mao right in the front courtyard, which almost every institution had. I mean, this thing must have been 40 foot high. And when I went back some years later and it had gone, the principal smiled and said, yes, we've given up our political superstitions. So that was, you know, they've just moved on. They don't want giant statues of the leader. And where you still find them, North Korea, for example, where you have statues you can practically see from the moon, it's an index of the sort of political ill health of the country, it seems to me.
It is. I mean, the psychology of these things is never terribly hard to figure out. They are designed, I think, to remind the population who's in charge. I mean, I can remember the first time I visited Baghdad, which was during the rule of Saddam Hussein, and it was very hard to look a couple of blocks in any direction without seeing a statue or a poster or a portrait of him. Florence, is there necessarily anything wrong with this? Isn't this the fun part of sloughing off an oppressor? You get to pull down all the statues, rename all the streets and so on and so on.
Yeah, but it's done partially, I think. What surprised me is to see that it had not been done yet in Ukraine. So
they did have quite a lot of them.
I wonder what's the case.
I don't know
how long
it takes to pull down like 1,300 statues.
These great theme parks where they all collect.
It's not a small undertaking.
Yeah, but that was so many years ago. And I wish I could have statistics on these other Eastern European countries. But yes, I mean, removing these statues is obviously important as a symbol.
But I think it's not just the Ukraine, or it's not just statues of Lenin. If you remember the absolutely vitriolic row in this country over whether to erect a statue to Bomber Harris,
a man
who's you know, a campaign of carpet bombing Germany had you know, might well be considered a war crime at this point. That was very bitter. And again, it's your view of history that's at stake here.
The difference being, though, in that case, that nobody was advocating building a statue of Bomber Harris in Dresden.
No, but nevertheless, how Britain reflects on its war record is still, you know, up for contestation at this point. There's a row going on in Edinburgh right now with the fact that there is only one statue of a woman in a city which is pretty heavily populated with statues. And that's to Bantu woman for some reason, which I now forget. There isn't a single statue to a Scottish woman in the whole of Edinburgh.
Florence, is the row over the Confederate statues in particular just that people have difficulty perceiving the difference between a monument, which is something you erect usually in admiration or reverence of somebody or something, and a memorial?
But it's the same. I mean, as you say, when you erect a statue, it's out of admiration. And then this admiration, with the years passing and the look we have on our history is definitely something very controversial. Look at the polemic that was in this country about Cecil Rhodes' statue in Oxford. So you can go on and on with those debates. I mean, they are still very much alive because, indeed, who was chosen to be magnified, whether it was only men, like you mentioned, in Scotland, whether it's former supporters of slave, like with Cecil Rhodes, or even like, I read this nice story in The Guardian recently, Admiral Nelson being presented as a slave advocate. So what are we going to do with this statue? So that's an interesting debate, more on the way we look at history in retrospect than about the personalities themselves, I think.
The difficulty being, I guess, that there is no hard and fast rule on these things, which which means we'll almost certainly be having this conversation again about another statue at some future point. For now, though, we are out of time. Florence Biederman and Isabel Hilton, thank you both for joining us. Today's show was produced by Marcos Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sophia Armadi. Our studio manager was Josh Prince. More music next at 1900. Daniel Giacopelli is in with the entrepreneurs. There's more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. I'm back with Midori House tomorrow at the same time, 1800 London. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.